thank you. And it's my understanding that you have had sufficient time and have decided that there is no issue for Judge Roy sitting. Is that correct, Counsel?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's correct.
Thank you both very much. With that, we can almost proceed to oral arguments. You should have gotten oral argument procedures, some instructions when you first came into court. You've had a chance to read them. Okay. And do you have any questions about them? Okay, your arguments are being video recorded and archived. If there's any confidential information, be careful about mentioning it. Otherwise, when you come to the podium, once again, announce who you are, name and attorney registration number. And I think with that, we can begin the arguments. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Curtis. My registration number is 925, which is lower than many here in this courtroom these days. I have read the instructions and read the suggestions about effective oral argument. One of them is that we should start with our strongest point first. It may be a character or perception deficiency on my point, but from our perspective, all three of our major points are strong, and so I proceed, the fact that I proceed in a particular order doesn't suggest otherwise. With respect to the issues, as the court well knows, there's three discrete ones, whether the trial court erred in finding twice, really, that the limits of UIM coverage for Ms. Bradford, the plaintiff, for $100,000, when in fact they are $300,000. Secondly, whether the trial court erred in calculating interest on the amount essentially of $70,000 instead of the $175,000 that was the jury's verdict. And lastly, assuming arguendo for the purposes of this case that the non-duplication clause in this USAA policy is enforceable. Again, assuming that arguendo for the purposes of this case only, our position is that regardless of the fact that it is assumed to be enforceable, in this case, the trial court erred because it went beyond what the limits and parameters of available evidence and information presented to the court would allow under different rules than the issue of whether or not it's enforceable. With respect to the first issue, there's really no dispute, I don't think, as I read the briefing, that the trial court did err with respect to the limits issue. It is, in fact, $300,000 and not $100,000, of course, twice found. We, as indicated in the briefing, don't raise that just because it's there. It's because it's important, because if it were only $100,000, then much of what we have to say would be moot because of the additional recovery would be excluded by that relatively low limit. But the fact that the limits are in fact $300,000 makes the other arguments viable and we think correct. I think that the position of the defense is that with respect to that USAA, I should say, is that with respect to that issue, it was error on the trial court's part, but it doesn't justify reversing the case for new trial, and we certainly agree with that. I think the statement is in the briefing from USAA that the most that should happen is it should be remanded with respect to that issue for just correction of the judgment to reflect the actual number rather than the $100,000 number, and that's what we think should happen as well with respect to that issue. Now, with respect to this second issue of the amount on which the interest was calculated, it's a significant point here. It matters to the tune of about $50,000 plus in terms of what Ms. Bradford was able to recover. And as the court is well aware, the jury verdict was for $175,000. The court deducted both The $100,000 that had been obtained through settlement with the liability insurance carrier, the $100,000 and $5,000 for the purported MedPay payments, which were available under the
I have two questions.
Yeah, sure.
This is a contract action, is it not?
It is.
It's not a tort action.
It is a contract action arising out of tort where the nature of damages are.
I understand. Do you know of a point in time in which USAA owed the plaintiff $175,000?
The point in time, I think, would be, I mean, it's a matter of law. They don't know it until the verdict enters and judgment enters on that verdict. But in looking in terms of the interest statute, the interest calculation statute, that of course begins to run from the time of the injury. That would, and then there is the $100,000 payment, which doesn't really bear on the court's question.
But the jury's verdict was merely to determine the damages from which the benefit under the UIM coverage would be measured.
That's correct.
So at no point, would you agree at no point did USAA owe $175,000?
Given the circumstances of the payment of the $100,000, yes. Because that portion of the obligation had been satisfied with the liability insurance.
So instead of having a $100,000 gap in the amount that interest would have been owed on, now the gap is $5,000.
Well, not the way I understand what that interest statute means and the consequences of the Supreme Court's case in the USAA Parker, and I always turn those terms around, but it's it's the case, of course, of USAA v. Parker, the 2009 case. Our point of view is that the new day dawned with that case, and that case says if the the person who's suing for UIM coverage, the major damages should be the same as that as it would have been the case had the suit been brought against the person at fault who had equal amounts of coverage, i.e. $300,000, and that you can't, because of the fact the fortuity of insurance being available, there's not a different measure of damages that applies. And so in all instances, you calculate the damages based on the jury verdict from the time of the accident. And if you don't do that, in this case or any other case, then you violate the precept, the sort of overarching precept, that the insured person, that person who has the UIM coverage, is not to be worse off or treated differently than would be the case if the verdict had been against a fully liability insured defendant. So the upshot of that is that you have to look only at the $175,000 offer, because that's what would have happened had the case been brought against the at-fault driver who had $300,000 in liability coverage.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And that we've quoted, I think, in our briefing, the bases for my saying that. I won't repeat the quotes here, but in detail at least, but the quotes that I was referencing from the language that's particularly pertinent in the case are at 200 Pacific 3rd, 358, 359 most. So I think basically that's our position with respect to the issue of whether there was error in terms of calculation being made on the basis of 70 versus 75. What I've just said sort of distills that, our position down.
I'd like to ask you about the interest. You mentioned your bar number. Mine is a little more than yours, but I'm still long in the tooth, so I'm going to ask for your experience. I've never seen a judge reopen a case to let in evidence that one side failed to bring in, except for maybe in a habitual criminal that's bifurcated. Have you?
Once, and I thought it was very weird. It didn't make sense to me.
Okay, I'll ask your opponent about that too.
Well, on direct examination, and your examination of your client, very early in the direct, you asked about her medical bills, which, as I recall, were $35,000 or so total.
Roughly.
And you asked her if they'd been paid or something to that effect, and she said $5,000 had been paid by USA under medical pay.
That's correct.
She Isn't that enough to satisfy? I mean, did they need the supplemental evidence in any event?
Yes. Our position is yes, they did. I mean, in Calderon, obviously, they said that there was a stipulation and agreement, and I don't know how far that stipulation and agreement went with respect to particulars, but she did testify that $5,000 had been paid in MedPay benefits of that $33,000 about it was. I think it appears in the transcript at like page 116. But what our focus is here is on the fact that the argument is, granted you can't have an offset under 10.4609, quote-unquote, an offset, but you can, under Calderon and others, enforce the terms of the duplicate benefits provision. But to do that, our position is to enforce those benefits, that position, and those provisions of the contract. That's not satisfied just by the council saying we paid $5,000 any more than it would be our burden to prove damages would be satisfied by my standing up and saying she got $270,000 in economic losses, she's got $400,000 in non-economic losses and $1.50 in physical impairment or whatever. Statements of counsel are obviously don't carry any weight. There has to be evidence. And if you don't have the evidence and or procedures such as was suggested by the court in the cases I've cited dealing with the old PIP benefits, if you don't have the evidence of what was paid to whom and by and in what amount, then how can you instruct or guide the jury with respect to whether or not they are about to enter upon a course which results in the award of duplicate benefits. In other words, and that's sort of a convoluted way of saying what I'm about to say now, we don't know whether they did or did not award duplicate benefits, that is the jury, because we don't know what they took into account. We don't know what they were instructed. We don't know what they did or didn't do. They may have awarded duplicate benefits, but they may not. So absent the...
In other words, they may not have awarded any medical benefits.
It is conceivable.
As a part of economic damage.
It's conceivable. I mean, we had $270,000, I think, in total shown, plus medical bills, of economic losses, including wages and loss of earning capacity. And so it's possible that the $70,000 in economic damages that the jury came up with did not take into account any medical expenses. We just don't know. And the way to avoid all that is to go through that sort of elimination process, which is talked about in those cases we cited, or simply to have proof of what the payments were and an instruction given to the jury that you may not award damages in this case for these billings, provider, data service, dollar. I have all of a minute and a half left, so I think I will reserve that for my response. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. My name is David Werber, representing the USA Casualty Insurance Company, registration number 28885. And as an initial matter, I think it's important to understand the procedural posture of this case that raised the issues that were brought up by Mr. Purvis. This case arises from an automobile accident in October of 2008. There was a subsequent settlement with the tortfeasor for policy limits.
And there appears to be nothing in the record to indicate that USAA consented to that. Did they, in fact, consent?
Yes. Plaintiff then pursued UIM benefits. They were unable to reach a resolution, which led to the underlying trial in this case. The case was tried to a jury with a verdict in favor of plaintiff of $175,000. And it's important to note that there are no questions about the evidentiary issues at trial, the exclusion of these minor issues, and there's no question that the jury verdict should be upheld. All of the issues in this case have to do with post-verdict actions by the trial court. And what those actions were was the court reduced the verdict by the $100,000 paid by the tortfeasor, by the $5,000 in medical pay benefits received by the plaintiff, and then calculated prejudgment interest off that net award of $70,000. USAA then paid that net award in an amount of in excess of $108,000, so an amount greater than the court's erroneous reference to $100,000 limits. And a partial satisfaction judgment was filed with respect to that $108,000 payment.
Do policy limits normally include interest?
Yes.
Is that just true in liability coverage, and it's also true in UIM coverage?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay.
Addressing the issues in the order they were raised by Mr. Purvis, we'll first look at the court's erroneous reference in its entry of judgment to the policy limits being $100,000. It is USAA's position that this is harmless error. As previously noted, USAA already paid the full amount of the judgment plus pre-judgment interest and post-judgment interest in an amount exceeding $108,000. Had they abided by the court's erroneous ruling, they would have issued a check for $100,000 and that's it. Because they have already paid the amount in excess of the court's error, that renders the court's erroneous reference in the judgment harmless because the full amount owed was paid. If the court here affirms the trial court's actions with respect to medical payments and prejudgment interest, plaintiff has already recovered every single penny she's entitled to, and there is no need to reverse on account of the court's clerical error because there's no substantive interest that the plaintiff has in such a reversal. In the event the Court of Appeals here reverses on either of those issues, it would serve to vacate the very judgment that's erroneous, rendering that issue moot. Turning to the more substantive issues, with respect to prejudgment interest, the manner in which this court, the trial court, calculated prejudgment interest is supported by longstanding legal precedent. In various factual scenarios, the courts have said that where another settling party pays a portion of the judgment, that's not to be considered, and the only part that is considered is the net judgment entered by the court, not the verdict of the jury. For example, when you had co-tortfeasors settling their case, one co-tortfeasor settled, one proceeded to trial, the reduction of the settlement with the co-tortfeasor was taken before interest was calculated.
And your counsel, your opposite counsel suggests that USAA versus Parker changed all those rules and basically made it out so that, hey, the interest is going to be calculated on the basis of what the total award would have been because, gee, maybe your tortfeasor who settles with the consent of USA didn't encompass interest and somebody should be encompassing interest over that period of time for the entire amount. So USAA changed the rules, your opposing counsel's term.
I believe that's an erroneous reading of Parker v. USAA. And to understand that, I think you need to understand the history. The first case to address this issue was Witt. And in that case, it said prejudgment interest does not account for the underlying, that the amount paid by the tortfeasor in settlement is subsumed in that settlement, and interest only accrues on the amount actually entered in judgment against the UIM carrier. That was next addressed by the Colorado Court of Appeals in Parker v. USAA. And in that case, the court addressed two issues pertinent here. The first of those was which is the applicable prejudgment interest statute, whether it was the personal injury statute or whether it was the wrongful withholding statute. And the court said it was the prejudgment interest statute because of the nature of the damages, not how the duty arises under contract. The second issue addressed by that court was then, how do you calculate prejudgment interest? And what they did was reiterate WIC and say, settlement subsumes interest on that amount, and we're only calculating off the net judgment. When the case was taken up by the Colorado Supreme Court, it only addressed one of those issues, the first of those issues, which was the appropriate statute. And they said the appropriate statute was the prejudgment interest statute, affirming the Court of Appeals. It did not address the second issue raised by the Colorado Court of Appeals. It didn't address WIC. It did not implicitly or expressly overrule WIC or the Court of Appeals on the issue of how to calculate prejudgment interest. What the Colorado Supreme Court addressed was solely the proper measure of prejudgment interest, whether it was 9% under the prejudgment interest statute or 8% under the wrongful withholding statute. The ruling of the Colorado Supreme Court did not extend beyond that issue and did not touch on the issue that faces us here.
But as your opponent has pointed out, first of all, the Supreme Court didn't even mention WIC, correct?
Correct, because that was not an issue before the court.
Okay, so you're extrapolating that the Supreme Court agreed with what the Court of Appeals did because it didn't mention it?
Well, I'm extrapolating that one, it didn't address that issue, so it didn't reverse the Court of Appeals on that issue. And second, what it did was affirm the Court of Appeals. There was no partial affirm or partial reversal. It affirmed that decision.
I understand. But what the Supreme Court did, Justice Bender talked about several times over two dissents, disagreed with them, is that we look at when someone has this uninsured, underinsured motorist policy, it's to protect them and put them in the same shoes they would have been as if the tortfeasor had that kind of coverage. And therefore, it may be, no matter how you treat it as a contract action or whether you're going to call it tort action, they recognize the difference between contract and tort, but they weren't persuaded like the two dissenters. They said, we want to put the plaintiff back in the same shoes he or she would have been in if the tortfeasor had this coverage. How does that square with your argument?
I don't believe it's inconsistent with my argument. What the plaintiff and Parker chose to do was settle its claim against the tortfeasor for policy limits. And what occurs by that is subsuming the interest into that settlement. Plaintiff could have opted not to settle and pursue the full amount of its claim against both the tortfeasor and either the UIM carrier as a defendant or intervener, or the UIM carrier sitting by the side watching and understanding its interests would be implicated. It's no different than, say, for a scenario where, for instance, a tortfeasor opts to settle for $90,000 on a $100,000 policy and then pursues UIM benefits in excess of the policy limits, leaving that $10,000 gap. They chose, for the purposes of certainty and immediacy, to give up a certain benefit that they could have received by making that settlement. And the same thing occurs here. They did not have to accept that money short of trial, but in the interest of certainty and in the interest of timeliness, they opted to reach a settlement, and that settlement subsumed the prejudgment interest on that settlement.
Does the language of the settlement support your argument? Is there anything in the settlement with USA that says what you're saying?
What it does is it fully terminates any liability of the tortfeasor. And with those damages...
Of the tortfeasor?
Correct. And that settlement for policy limits subsumed any damages available from the tortfeasor. And what has long been established is that when you settle with a tortfeasor, you are settling not just the damages claim, but also any prejudgment interest you might have been entitled to had you taken that case to trial.
But the tortfeasor only had a certain amount of insurance. Why wouldn't the plaintiff take it? Well, what you're suggesting is as a tactical matter, and I'm not saying you're right or wrong, I'm just trying to understand it. As a tactical matter, a plaintiff should refuse a settlement for approximately the tortfeasor's limits so that later on they can sue him in court and maybe get more from his or her own insurance company. That's your position?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, if the tortfeasor were Warren Buffett with $100,000 covered.
In that case, I don't think we'd be here because the UIM carrier would never consent to settlement if the damages were clearly in excess of the policy limits and would instead pay those policy limits to the tortfeasor, get an assignment of the claim, and pursue Warren Buffett on their own for the full amount of any damages. I don't think we'd be in a situation where there'd be a settlement, or it would be a settlement without consent, which would sever any right to UIM benefits.
As for the $5,000, changing subjects, as Judge White pointed out, the plaintiff did admit that she took the $5,000. If that were the case, why did USAA need to come back with documentation?
Well, the documentation, I believe, really was focused on providing the policy language that the court requested. So how this occurred was before trial, both at the pretrial conference and in trial briefing, the issue of this medical payments offset was raised. There was no dispute that the $5,000 was paid. There was no dispute that there was a non-duplication provision. In fact, the only argument raised before trial by plaintiff was that the non-duplication provision was not enforceable. Post-trial, the judge said, I don't have the policy language and I would like to see it, and it was provided.
Why couldn't the issue have been presented to the jury with an appropriate instruction? And if it could have been, why wasn't it?
Well, I believe that statutorily there's a prohibition on entering evidence of collateral source, and certainly Calderon considered this benefit of collateral source. So entering that into evidence would have been contrary to statute, and I believe it also would have been created under Rule 403, a substantial danger of confusion that wasn't warranted. As indicated, I think, by the Calderon decision, the appropriate manner to handle this is a post-verdict set-off and not any.
But how do we know, as counsel suggested, how do we know that they haven't already discounted this $5,000 already?
They were instructed to award all damages. And the presumption is that the jury is going to follow the instructions of the court. Here they were expressly instructed all damages incurred by plaintiff were to be awarded.
And so because they had also been informed of the settlement, they necessarily included the $175,000 in the damages award?
I believe that the jury would have followed the instructions and considered all of the presented evidence regarding medical expenses of plaintiff, which included the $5,000 that were paid by USAA, all evidence of wage loss past and future, and all the evidence regarding non-economic damages and impairment. And then they came up with a figure of $175,000. I think you create a boondoggle if you say you have to specifically provide evidence of each payment to show that there's duplication. Not only within respect to a UIM case, where you'd then be asking the jury to consider every bill and every part of it, but it would have far broader implications. For example, a statutory hospital lien, right? They file a hospital lien, there's a judgment, they're entitled to collect from that judgment. And that assumes it's because that lien was part of that judgment. Now you're saying, well, no, you can't collect on that hospital judgment because the jury didn't say the hospital bills you're seeking were awarded as part of the judgment. The same thing with the settlement with a co-tortfeasor. What did that tortfeasor settle for versus what the jury awarded against the other tortfeasor? If you're going to ask for an itemization of damages, you're opening Pandora's box in a way that's just not viable. When you look at medical pay benefits, they're payable only for reasonable, necessary, causally related benefits. Now you have a plaintiff here who's saying, well, maybe we submitted a claim for and received payment for benefits under Medicaid we weren't entitled to. I think it's reasonable to assume that the reasonable necessary benefits paid under MedPay were the reasonable necessary causally related medical benefits awarded by the jury. And if you take away that assumption, you create an unviable situation for trial courts and for juries in the manner in which they have to consider damages, and will create an unprecedented need for detail in verdict forms that's never been utilized.
First, a comment. It seems anomalous to me that in a contract action, neither party saw fit to introduce the contracts into the record. But secondly, no one asked, I assume, for a breakdown of the damages from the jury, an allocation of damages between economic and non-economic and different types of economic and non-economic damages.
I believe the only breakdown was between the three standard categories of damages, economic.
And they did give three numbers totaling $175,000?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I will be brief as I must. It seems to me with respect to the USAA v. Parker, all that needs to be said at this point is that the language of the case speaks for itself and does so repeatedly as Judge Rothenberg has indicated. And the effect of that language is to essentially neutralize, if not overrule, sub silentio, the cases that were cited in part of the landscape prior to USAA v. Parker. Second point is that there was some suggestion that that if you, by proving what you're required to prove duplication of benefits, you're entering somehow into Rule 403 territory, which makes no sense. I mean, we have the obligation to prove the elements of our damages claim. They have the obligation to prove the elements of their defense claim, which is essentially payment. And they can't satisfy that simply by the statements of counsel or by a conclusory affidavit saying we paid it. In effect, what they're trying to do here is, and I say this only in effect, is achieve a set-off of $5,000, irrespective of what the state of the record is with respect to whether there was duplication of benefits or not. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course.